To start the chain reaction, all we need is one neutron. We have inherited a wealth of knowledge from the great thinkers of the past. The atomic reactor, then, gives us a chance to make the atomic genie our friend. I think you can see what is going to happen. Watch.
Oh, man. Was I gone for a little while? I hardly notice now. I mean, time flies by so quickly now, I just work in the 9-to-5 life, or when, you know, when you're trying to get ahead, the 9-to-9 life kind of slips away from you. But of course, that is no excuse to leave you guys in the lurch. For that, I do apologize again. But I wasn't completely sitting around the last couple months since the last episode. And let me tell you, some of you may have noticed me at the ANS meeting most recently, going around shaking the tin can for alms, and by alms, I mean requests for interviews, and I am sitting on a ton of them, just waiting to release them when the time is right and when the stars align. What do I mean by that? Well, all will be revealed. But for those of you who are still listening to this program, it's also been more than a year since I launched, which is kind of crazy to think about. But I thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Doug Hartmeyer. I want to welcome you back to this episode of Radio Nuclear. But today we got a very cool guest on today, much cooler than I am, although that's not saying much, Dr. Christopher Morrison, who, on his title on LinkedIn, goes by Astronuclear Engineer. What possibly could we be talking about? Well, some of you probably already deduced we're going to be talking about nuclear in space and the vital role it can play there, because oftentimes we don't think about that a lot. It's not something top of mind, and we'll get into all that in the details later. But first, let's roll right into the news, because there's something that's been bugging me and I want to get to it. But let's talk about Hanford, or at least the nuclear advocates side of Hanford, and what's been going on up there in the news recently, because the news cycle on this has been remarkably one-sided. And I want to get into that, but I want to kind of go over the history of Hanford for a little bit, because this is something that I'm fairly familiar with. I've done a lot of studying with this area, and it's something that I personally didn't hear a lot in school. Maybe not many of you have heard too much about Hanford and what used to go on there and all that sort of stuff and where they're at today, but I want to go into that because I think it tells an important story for the industry as a whole and definitely serves as a good opportunity to educate on maybe what to do and what not to do. So the DOE has been making a lot of waves and a lot of op-ed pieces I've been seeing, especially in the nuclear smart briefs, about changing the way they classify some of their tank waste. And we'll get into what tank waste is here in a minute. But a lot of watchdog groups and activists are opposed to doing this because their argument, or at least the way they perceive this action, is that this will leave more of the waste in the ground. But of course, that's not the whole story. But before we dive into that, what is Hanford? So Hanford was a Manhattan Project site. General Leslie Groves marched on up there and decided that the Hanford Plateau would be a perfect place to place reactors to help build weapons-making material. And the first reactor they built there was called the Hanford B Reactor. Now, I was fortunate enough to find myself in the area there a couple months ago, and it turns out that the Hanford B Reactor is a perfectly preserved National Historic Site, and you can actually go get tours of it for free from the spring to the fall. And it was honestly one of my favorite tours of a museum that I've gone on, not only because you just got to see the scale of this first reactor that they built in a year, from a greenfield site to critical and in such a short time, but just the fact that the workers that are there, they're not workers, they're volunteers, but they used to be workers at the Hanford site. And they get to give you a whole bunch of context on what the site was like in its peak. And it's just crazy that the scale and the amount of effort that went into building this one place to help win World War II. And it certainly played a vital aspect in that. So after this, in the Cold War, the number of reactors began to increase. And at its peak, Hanford had 9 of these reactors, all located along the Columbia River. And what they would do is they would shove fuel rods into this big graphite pile, neutrons would bombard the fuel and create plutonium. They then, it kind of looks like a pole vault, but they would shove these fuel rod elements out the backside of the reactor while it was still running, and then go collect these little fuel rods and put them in a basket and put them on a train to a place to be processed. And while there's some various chemical extraction techniques used to get that plutonium out of those fuel rods, the most popular one, I'll call it, is called the Purex process. Now, Purex is an acronym that stands for Plutonium Uranium Redox Extraction. And basically, what this process does is use a series of chemicals to extract that plutonium, the stuff that you want in this weapons-making case, out of that spent fuel, and the rest is just kind of washed away. I know, that's a gross simplification of the process, but bear with me here. In order to get this plutonium out, you need to use a lot of chemicals. And after you get the plutonium out, you still have the chemical waste, which now has a lot of fission products dissolved in it. Because remember, inside spent nuclear fuel, you get a whole litany of different elements, some radioactive, some not. But once you get the plutonium, the uranium out using this Purex process, you're left with what is called the raffinate. Now, Wikipedia, which is surprisingly detailed for this process, you wouldn't think it would be, but it is, describes raffinate as the mixtures of metals and nitric acid which are left behind when the uranium and plutonium have been removed by the Purex process from a nuclear fuel dissolution liquor. So that's basically everything else, and they have a little chart of kind of what that raffinate looks like. But this raffinate is waste, and you got to do something with it. And at the time, they didn't really know what to do with it, right? Priority number one was getting the weapons-grade materials to make weapons. The rest was just kind of, well, let's take this raffinate and we'll put it in single-shell tanks, big steel tanks. And so over the course of Hanford's operation, the site accrued some 55 million gallons or so of this waste that's still sitting there today. Now, this presents a problem because this waste, it's pretty caustic, it's fairly radioactive, can eat through the shells of these tanks. And it's been found that some of these single-shell tanks have eroded to the point where this is leaking out into the groundwater. So what was initially done was a bunch of double-shell tanks. So there's an inside hull, an air gap, and then an outer hull were constructed, placed in the ground, and the leaking single-shell tank waste was transferred to these new double-shell tanks. Unfortunately, some of them are leaking as well. So in 1989, the DOE, Department of Ecology of Washington State, which is where Hanford's located, and the EPA all signed the notorious Tri-Party Agreement, which is a court order mandating that the DOE turn this raffinate, from here on out I'll call it tank waste, into glass logs. This is also called vitrification. But here's where it gets a little bit tricky. This waste form is very technically difficult to deal with. And to try and vitrify all of this tank waste, DOE commissioned Bechtel National to build and commission the world's largest radioactive waste treatment plant ever. So they're going to suck out this tank waste, send it to a facility where they essentially separate this waste into high-level and low-level waste. And these aren't technically specific terms, all right? This is just for the sake of describing the facility, your high-level and low-level stuff. At both of these facilities, high and low-level, they're going to vitrify this waste and turn it into glass logs. These logs will be surrounded by steel canisters, and the low-level steel canisters will be deposited in a trench on site, whereas the high-level waste will be shipped off to an appropriate repository. Now, getting this big facility has proved a lot more challenging than was expected. And the DOE is taking responsibility for the tank waste and is looking for outside-of-the-box ways to fix the problem. So let's fast forward to today and how they're framing the argument about what's going on out there. So I jump into my first article, which is an editorial from the Yakima Herald called "Money Should Not Be a Factor in the Hanford Waste Cleanup." The editorial starts off, "This hasn't exactly been the most glowing," sorry for a choice of words, of news cycles for people concerned about the safety of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. In the span of the last few days, the federal government, the United States Department of Energy to be exact, made headlines by seeking to reclassify high-level radioactive waste to, quote, lower its threat level, end quote, which would save the Energy Department billions of dollars and countless logistical headaches by simply leaving considerable toxic material in the ground, potentially putting public health at risk. Skipping down, yes, we know the price tag of the Hanford cleanup is steep, close to $2 billion a year. Likely, there are inefficiencies and wastefulness in Hanford's operating budget, but its mandate to clean up the mess is the price the government must pay for its nuclear weapons policies. Now here's where it gets interesting. The federal government should be hastening the removal, not looking for ways to save a buck by, decades after the fact, attempting to change rules on what constitutes high and low levels of toxicity. As Tom Carpenter, Hanford Challenge's executive director, Hanford Challenge is a watchdog out there, recently told reporters, quote, the Tri-Cities should be very, very worried. There is not much point of doing much else if they don't clean up the high-level waste. The editorial does at least cite Congressman Dan Newhouse, who acknowledged in a statement that the government is, quote, legally and morally responsible for cleaning up Hanford. Newhouse, however, believes the federal government is right to study reclassification, noting that currently levels of waste are determined by the method the waste is produced, not necessarily its radioactivity level. Come again? What was that? Well, you heard that right. Currently, the way the DOE classifies its nuclear waste is essentially based off of where it comes from. And a lot of the stuff that's in these tanks is considered waste incidental to reprocessing, which is considered high-level waste. Now, what's that kind of like doing? It'd be similar to if you ran a recycling company, and instead of recycling the recyclables based off of what they are, like aluminum, paper, plastic, it'd kind of be like, well, you know, I'm going to classify these recyclables based off of where they come from. For example, this is all the recyclables that came from a school, and this is the stuff that came from office buildings, and this is hospital recyclables. It doesn't make a lot of sense, right? And so simply, the DOE has acknowledged that, look, we need to look at this in a more practical standpoint if we want to make some progress here. Because both the DOE and the editorial writer in this case have the same goal, which is to hasten the process at which we can immobilize this waste. That should be priority number one. And they do have plans to do that. And I don't really have time to talk too much about it. But so I'll link the article, which is from the Tri-City Herald, titled Fed's Push for Low-Cost Commercial Treatments of Hanford Waste, State Has Concerns, by Annette Carey, published July 23rd of 2018, begins by saying that the Department of Energy is making plans to encase 2,000 gallons of waste now held in Hanford's underground tanks in concrete-like grout, part of a continuing demonstration project. DOE recently released a fact sheet that indicated its interest in continuing the demonstration project and listing what it sees as the benefits of the project called the Test Bed Initiative. The project is a departure from plans to turn radioactive and hazardous chemical waste into a stable glass form at the $17 billion vitrification plant under construction at the nuclear reservation. But the DOE still needs to get other parties on board. The first phase of the demonstration project, grouting 3 gallons of the 56 million gallons, I know, a drop in the bucket, but they gotta start somewhere, of waste held in Hanford's underground tanks was successfully completed in December. This would have been in December 2017. The waste was sent to a nearby Permafix Environmental Solutions in Richland to be encapsulated in concrete-like grout. It was then sent to the Waste Control Specialist Disposal Cell built for low-level government waste in Texas. Well, that's great, right? Well, that's great. You would think that all these people would be on board to help speed up the process of solidifying this waste, but of course that's not the case. This is another example, and I'll have to throw it in the pile that's forming behind me, of cases where not all the facts are reported behind this story. So the DOE demonstrates that they do have safe ways of immobilizing this low-level waste. and that by changing the outdated regulations of what the definition of low-level waste is will allow them to treat even more of this tank waste. People should be ecstatic about this because this fixes the issue, but the knee-jerk reaction is always that the DOE is being nefarious and that they're just doing it to save money. So if that's the case, why don't we just ask the DOE what they're really trying to do here? Is there a reason that they could possibly do this besides money? You think anyone from these editorial pages is reaching out to find the other side of the story? And no, I know it's an editorial, but even in regular articles about this, it's always that the DOE is up to no good and all that stuff. I'm sick of seeing it. So I'll link you below a presentation that someone from DOE actually gave explaining their decision to reclassify this high-level waste. And right here, slide 6, it says, what problems does high-level waste redefinition solve? A shift to basing treatment and disposal decisions on the actual characteristics of the waste, not where it's from, and risk to human health and the environment rather than the origin can potentially, 1, cut years of operations, 2, accelerate tank retrievals and closures, 3, clear the way for tanks to be closed more easily, 4, allow the treated high-level waste that qualifies as transuranic waste to go to WIP or a private facility before a high-level repository is available, and 5, realize savings of more than $40 billion, because there's tanks beyond Hanford that this would be applicable to. You have Savannah River Site, you have Summit Idaho National Lab, and you have Summit West Valley in New York. There's many places where this can be applicable and can help all across the board. This simply removes the roadblocks to help solve the issue that so many have been so worried about for so long. It's a great thing, but you'll never hear it. Because as always, whenever a nuclear entity wants to do something for the greater good of society, the last person to be asked why they're doing something is the nuclear entity. And in this case, that entity is the DOE. I know it took me a while to go over that, but I really wanted to cover that because I've not heard anyone telling that side of the story. And so I hope that maybe you learned something for that. Maybe, Doug, you don't know what you're talking about. I don't know. But hopefully that helped arm you with a bit of knowledge that when you hear someone saying that the DOE doesn't care about what they're doing and this is terrible, you'll have some facts in your back pocket to pull them out and say, no, actually, they're trying to fix the problem. The same thing that you want them to do. All right, let's move along from that one. I'm gonna take a couple deep breaths here. We're gonna move into the next story. The article is titled, and you'll find out why I picked it here in just a second, "A Nuclear Tunneling Worm Could Help Us Find Out What's Beneath Europa's Ice. NASA Reveals a Concept Model for a New Kind of Icy Challenge." Published in Popular Mechanics and written by David Grossman, on December 17th of 2018. The article begins, "Europa, a moon of Jupiter, is one of the most intriguing bodies in the solar system. Ever since the Galileo spacecraft discovered evidence of a liquid ocean underneath its icy exterior, scientists have wondered at the chance of life, or at least the evidence of extinct life, beneath. While the Europa Clipper's launch is to be determined, scientists are already working on the big problem of getting through all that ice to see what's below. Working with NASA, a team of scientists have proposed a solution, a nuclear-powered tunneling robot." Oh yeah, let's bring it on. Man, I'd love to see this. Now, as you can imagine, being on Europa, quite cold, quite far out in space, a lot farther away from the sun than we are, has a lot of ice. And NASA needs to get through it so we can figure out if there's life or not, one of the greatest questions mankind has ever asked. And that ice in some places is between 2 and 30 kilometers. That's about 1.2 miles and 18.6 miles thick. Now NASA realizes that they can't just send some guy up there with a pickaxe and just tell him to whack through it and find out what's going on. They are very smart and think outside of the box probably better than anyone else in the world. They did get us to the moon after all, and they've decided to use the most reliable power source to help them do it. And this is a growing trend with NASA that we see, that they're shifting towards nuclear power to help us propel the reaches of humanity beyond the realm of just the Earth. This is something that I talked about in my TED Talk, and just another example about how nuclear technology has so much left to still offer us that we haven't tapped into because people, like the ones protesting the DOE decision, want to shelve it. Last two paragraphs of the article go on to say that, quote, "The robot wouldn't simply be mindlessly bashing through Europa and ice." The article wraps up by saying that the robot wouldn't simply be mindlessly bashing through Europa and ice. Like NASA's recently developed ice worm, it would be taking samples every step of the way. This includes the ability to take samples of water within the ice shell, the underside of the ice at the bottom of the shell, and even water at the nexus of the water-ice interface at the surface of the European Ocean. The drill would be connected to a lander and humanity through a series of fiber-optic cables. While there's still some time before a mission to Europa moves from science fiction to science fact, NASA wants every hypothetical option on the table. Now, I can't legally be a bookie here, but if I could, hypothetically speaking, I would put my money on that this thing's going to be nuclear powered. And I'm willing to take bets on that now. Except again, I can't legally do that. But what I'm saying is, there's no other option, right? You're this far off into space. You need something to drill through almost 18 miles of ice in some places, which, as fate would probably have it, that's where the good stuff probably is. You need something to get through there. And the best option on the table, the lightest, the most compact, the most energy dense, the best way to get through that is with some nuclear power source. And NASA realizes this. They realize that there's still a lot that this technology can have to offer and can help them find out and unlock the secrets of our universe, which is such, it's such a cool thing. And that's why, segue time, I am very happy that our next guest will be joining us here after the break. Be sure to stay tuned. All right, well, today I am happy to be joined by Dr. Christopher Morrison. Now, some of you may have seen his YouTube videos, which I'll link in the description below, talking all about nuclear in space. So I know it's a topic some of you are interested in, so I'm happy to have a guest on the show to talk to us a little bit about that, but enough of me yapping on. Chris, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in the nuclear industry?
So I've always been an aerospace fanatic. From a young age, I read up a lot on things like the SR-71 and the Saturn V rocket, and I decided to pursue that career in my undergrad at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And while I was studying aerospace, I was looking around and saying, what is the contribution I want to make to aerospace? And for a while, I was looking at things like SpaceX and saying, hey, look at this launch industry that commercial industry is just now starting to launch things into orbit. This is going to be a big deal. Let's see if I can get on in a company doing that. But as I got a little bit further on, and especially when I was at this critical juncture of at the very end of my undergrad, I was considering, you know, should I pursue my PhD? Should I go out into industry? I decided to look around a little bit more, and I said, what is an area that's crucial for space exploration that just isn't being worked on? And the more that I looked around, I initially got started with something called ion propulsion, which is a really efficient way to travel around the solar system. But what I discovered is there's plenty of electric ion engines, but the missing piece is the power source, that what is going to power your spacecraft throughout the solar system, and what's going to power your colony on the moon or on Mars. So I decided actually to take a good look into nuclear power, and I emailed one astronaut, actually. His name is Dr. Franklin Chang Diaz. He was one of the people. He has a research project on what's called the Vasmir, which is an electric engine. And basically what I said was, I think your engine is great, but it's kind of like a jet engine with no jet fuel. And he actually replied to me, and that kind of started off a few emails. And when I was applying to different graduate schools, I mostly applied for aerospace. But when I was visiting one of the schools up in New York, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, I ran into a nuclear professor. And I asked him, what do you think about space nuclear power? And I was very fortunate to come across a research advisor that, you know, he was willing to do research that wasn't necessarily in his wheelhouse. And he said, I think it's a great idea. Why don't you come study at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute? And I was Dr. Leji's student. And while I was in graduate school, backing up a little bit, I was interning actually at NASA JPL right before graduate school. And I had already kind of decided that I would go to graduate school, but I was having a few reservations because I'm thinking, okay, nuclear is definitely a technology that's needed for space for quite a few reasons that I think I'll get into later. But, you know, is this something that can actually happen in the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years in my professional career? So Elon Musk was giving the commencement speech at Caltech in 2012. And after the commencement speech, I decided to go run him down. And me and a few other people chased him down. He actually turned around and took a few minutes to talk to us. And I introduced myself and said I was looking at space nuclear power for graduate school. And he said, oh, that would be very useful for Mars. So I decided that there was at least one, you know, credible, viable, commercial path to moving forward in this industry. So I decided to pursue space nuclear power. And while my actual thesis was on a more general topic on nuclear fuel design and how you design your fuel to get better passive safety effects in basically gas-cooled high-temperature reactors. I stayed around the community, and there's a small, tight-knit space community that goes all the way back, you know, even to the 1960s. But back in the 1960s, we knew how to do nuclear. There was the NERVA project, which is a nuclear rocket where we actually built, over a dozen prototype nuclear rockets on the ground and tested them. There was the SNAP program in the 1960s that, tested radioisotope thermal generators, which are what we use today on missions like Curiosity or Voyager. And then there was even a fission-powered space reactor launched by the United States in 1965. And, you know, we knew how to do nuclear back then, but we said, okay, we're not going to Mars. We're not pushing out into space in a meaningful way after Apollo ended. And, you know, let's put all these technologies on a shelf and revisit them when we're ready. And kind of the space nuclear community has been kind of this wave of, you know, there might be a potential funding source from NASA or from the Department of Defense, and then it kind of goes bust, and then there's a drought for a while, and then it kind of comes back up. And there are a few notable projects. Some of them were including Reagan's Star Wars, that for a while they thought they were going to have basically nuclear-powered lasers up in space to shoot down ICBMs for Star Wars. And then there was a NASA project that was going to design basically a mobile, you can think of it as a nuclear submarine for space, that actually the people designing it was the Knowles Atomic Power Lab, which currently designs the reactors for subs. So This community has been around, and I kind of got involved with them, and I met some very interesting, at the time they were PhD students, And they were working quite a bit on the nuclear thermal rocket, which NASA is funding at kind of very low levels currently, enough to where they can get some designs, and they're actually funding a fuel prototype right now for it. But there was some research being done in this area, and a group out at the Idaho National Lab called the Center for Space Nuclear Research had this great summer fellowship program. So they would bring in typically grad students and have them, you know, the projects were actually quite advanced and quite, you know, there were things like design a space reactor for the moon, or design a, you know, there's actually a design that looked at going through the ice on one of the ice moons, Europa. And throughout all these projects, there's kind of a young cadre of space nuclear engineers. And when we got to the end of our graduate school, we're all recently minted PhDs, we looked around and we said, you know, what can we do to move forward? And basically, I got involved with them, and now I'm working with most of the people that I had worked with at that point on a lot of space nuclear design that I'll get into more detail on the company that I worked for. But generally what I do today in my day-to-day is looking at putting what is the first reactor we can put in space? What are the power requirements for humans in space? And there's a lot of, I can get into great detail and depth into all of these areas, but I think that answers your first question, which is my background.
So certainly an interesting background, I'll give you that too. And, you know, the reason why I wanted to have you on the program was to talk a little bit about nuclear in space and ways that we could use it, because nuclear in space is not often a topic that comes to top of mind for a lot of people.
So in terms of space, one of the key aspects is that you need energy, whether that energy be used for propulsion, whether it's used for powering life support, growing food. And, you know, one of the examples I use is food. On Earth, we take for granted growing food, because on Earth, we have biological processes and we have, you know, great big fields. And for every person on Earth, you average about an acre of land to feed that person. And if you actually look at the amount of energy hitting that acre of land, it's on the order of gigawatts of energy hit that acre of land. And, you know, there's a lot of waste and inefficiency associated with, you know, growing food, harvesting the food, taking the food to market. Some of it spoils. But if you boil it down to the most efficient system possible, that even though humans, we are about the power of I used to say a light bulb, but light bulbs have gotten more efficient these days, but we're about a 100-watt animal that our body produces about 100 watts of thermal heat continuously, of, you know, 2,000 calories a day. But the inefficiency in our body digesting food, the inefficiency in plants growing food, that using traditional agriculture, that you basically need 100 times more, you know, the average household in the United States uses somewhere around, you know, 1 to 3 kilowatts of energy continuously. But to live in space and grow food, just to grow food alone, you'll need 100 times that. So you'll need on the order of 200 kilowatts of continuous electric energy or photonic energy to grow food. Because in space, you know, if you're on the moon rotates, you know, it has 15 days of darkness and 15 days of light. And, you know, if you're trying to grow food and you have 15 days of darkness and you're on a planet with no atmosphere and you have to put it all in a greenhouse, and all these aspects come together that basically you need to grow your food with light that you provide yourself. And that's an incredible amount of energy. So a lot of people these days, we're talking about, you know, launch costs going down, that, you know, now that we've got SpaceX, now that we've got Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin, that the cost to launching something in orbit has gone from the price of its weight in gold, so that's roughly $10,000 a pound, and it's come down to more like $1,500 a pound. So we've gotten almost a 10 times decrease in cost for the cost of spaceflight. And when you look at nuclear has something, at least when you look at fission has something called a critical mass, that the reactor has to be a certain size to be turned on. And at the end of the day, if that reactor weighs a few metric tons, then you compare that to a few metric tons of gold, right? And you just say, this is unsustainable. It's just too expensive to put big things like nuclear power systems to put people in space. Like the International Space Station today is the most expensive object ever built in human history at about $100 billion. And, space was just too expensive to even think about nuclear power systems. And the only ones that you could put in space were the Russians put up 33 high-enriched uranium reactors to detect our ships in the water back in the Cold War. If we wanted to actually enable a commercial industry in space, we would have to use lower enrichments. And when you use lower enrichments, your kind of critical mass comes out to be that you need, honestly, a few metric tons of material to put something in space. So, I guess the first point I want to emphasize is it's kind of like the price of spaceflight dropping is now opening the door to thinking about larger power systems and thinking about, going beyond Earth's orbit and going to places, especially the moon. The moon's been a big target on the radar in terms of the Trump administration and what its priorities are. And next week, for example, I'm going to the Lunar Planetary Institute's workshop on, titled it Survive the Lunar Night. And, as I mentioned, the lunar night is 15 days long. The fact of the matter is if you want to put people on the moon just to power the technologies that recycle the air and water, you need on the order of about 10 kilowatts per person. So if you're thinking a colony of maybe 5 people on the moon is maybe an initial setup, you're going to need about 50 kilowatts of energy to power that. So if you look at your options, if you want to use, you have two options. You have solar and you have nuclear. There's really no other options in most space environments. And with solar, the number of batteries that you would need to last those 15 days and the backups and everything basically make it where the batteries are greater than 90% of that system mass. Now, if you look at nuclear, nuclear is much more compact. It's much more deployable in that you ship it there on a lander and it basically sits there and produces energy. It doesn't have to be deployed per se. There's a lot of operational benefits to that. And my coworkers and I, we've taken our fuel, our silicon carbide FCM fuel, and we've combined it with some advanced moderators. And we've been able to get a system that's small enough that it will fit on what's called a Blue Moon lander. So Jeff Bezos, he's the founder of Amazon, the richest man in the world currently. He has an aerospace company called Blue Origin, just like Elon Musk has SpaceX. But Jeff Bezos is particularly interested in the moon at the moment, and he's been pushing a plan called the Blue Moon Plan. And this involves going to the surface of the moon, and to get to the surface of the moon, you need a rocket that can take you to the orbit of the moon, and then a lander, in the case of Blue Origin, to go from the orbit of the moon to the ground, kind of like the Apollo LM vehicle. So this lander is being sized for about 5 metric tons. So my colleagues and I took our design tools and some of these advanced moderators, and we've basically put together what we consider to be the highest power system So this includes not just the reactor, but the power conversion pieces that turn the heat into electricity. And it sits on this Blue Moon lander. And, you know, that could be possibly, at least from a commercial point of view, one of the first steps. And then, of course, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Kilopower, that Kilopower is a great effort being done by NASA right now to create a, you know, it's a very simple, you know, stupid simple reactor that has very well-known properties that, you know, it's basically a on-off switch. That it's a metal core. It's uranium metal mixed with a little bit of molybdenum that's about the size of a roll of paper towels. And then it's surrounded by a reflector, and then it has some heat pipes attached to it, and they're connected to these Stirling engines to produce electricity. And this is what I would call the simplest system that you could launch that is useful. And they're looking at about 10 kilowatt-sized units, and they want to power science missions. They want to power kind of the lunar missions. And I think that that's a great first step, that NASA can take that first step and prove out the regulatory pathways. And then the next step is what NASA is currently using is not commercial-grade uranium. It's higher enrichments. And it's not something that I would call enabling a sustainable economic future for commercial enterprise. So we believe that the reactor that I mentioned, which we've called the pylon after kind of a vague reference to the power source in the StarCraft series, but the pylon reactor that we've kind of built out there is kind of us saying, hey, look, you know, the technology that we've developed for terrestrial application, you know, we have our MMR, our micromodular reactor for the Canadian Arctic. What does the Canadian Arctic remind some people of? Well, you know, you might think of Mars and the moon when you think of places like the Canadian Arctic. So we're taking that same technology, putting it into a smaller package and basically saying, hey, look, this same technology that we've pioneered can enable commercial enterprise in places like the moon. It's worth mentioning Mars as well, because Mars is kind of, that's Elon Musk. You know, you have Jeff Bezos, who isn't quite as Mars focused, and you have Elon Musk, who is laser focused on Mars itself. But Mars has about 42% of the sunlight of Earth. And that's actually reasonably good. You could actually think of solar power on Mars, and but there is one complicating factor, and that's the fact that about every 5 years there's a big dust storm, which more or less blots out the sun for a few months completely. So I think that the optimal solution in a place like Mars is a combination of technologies. You have solar and nuclear working together to provide the maximum amount of reliability for humans in space. And I'll also quickly mention that there's two types of nuclear in space. There's nuclear batteries or radioisotope thermal generators, and then there's the fission power reactors. So we've been using the nuclear batteries for years. We've launched, dozens of them. And, you know, one of them is powering the Voyager probe, which it left the entire solar system. It's actually out into cosmic space currently. And believe it or not, it's still in communication with Earth because it has this nuclear battery inside of it. But these nuclear batteries are, if you have a nuclear battery, it produces a certain amount of power for every amount of mass. Like, so if you have one battery, it produces 500 watts per, it produces 500 watts per kilogram. So if you have two batteries, you have a kilowatt. If you have three batteries, you have 1.5 kilowatts. So the battery scales what we call linearly, but the actual fission reactors, the ones that I'm talking, that I've talked about for most of the program, those have what I mentioned is a critical mass, that you have to have enough nuclear material to form a critical mass. But once you have a critical mass, you can bring it to any power you want. You can operate at 1 watt, or you can operate at a megawatt, or even a gigawatt. And your key concern with the fission system is that you're able to remove the heat properly. So when you're talking about humans in space, you're talking about bringing people, that we need a power source that can provide more energy than the traditional nuclear battery can. So that's kind of where I think the fission power systems and come in, that once you start needing around a kilowatt, or, you know, around, you know, a couple kilowatts, that it really makes sense to pioneer these fission technologies. So coming full circle, I think that the big thing is that the cost of spaceflight has dropped enough that now we can start considering these fission power systems, which can reach much higher powers than power densities. And this can enable a future scientific and commercial economy that is kind of currently being bootstrapped by billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk.
Man, you know what, Chris? You are a very easy interview. I think in your last response there, you answered just about every follow-up question I think I could have possibly asked. But I'll end with a popular closer of mine. What's one thing that you wish people knew about the nuclear industry? Is there anything that you just wish people knew about the work you do?
Yeah, I do, actually. This is something that I think is for your listeners that come from a nuclear background, but maybe not a space background. And what I want to say is that space is very radioactive, or relatively highly radioactive. That when we think of putting astronauts in space, when we think about putting, you know, colonies on the moon, on Mars, that there are certain particles that have such a large amount of energy that it requires multiple meters of a material to stop them. So when you look at astronauts, and when you look at people going to space, this is where we can actually learn about low-dose radiation. That you may have had some speakers on the show before that have talked about things like hormesis, and have talked about the fact that linear no threshold, which is the idea that, you know, every little bit of radiation that you're exposed to, and every time you get hit by a radioactive particle, that's one chance to get cancer. And back in the 1950s and 60s, when they first came up with that system, it was a reasonable system because we didn't have the data to really do anything more complicated. And today, you have events like, you know, Chernobyl. Depending on who you talk to, Chernobyl either killed a couple dozen people or it killed millions of people. And there's no way to, you know, there's statisticians that can argue, you know, this is statistically significant or not. There's no easy way to say, you know, what is the real threat of radiological damage to the human body? And I think that space gives us a natural environment that's about 100 times more radioactive than the background on Earth, that will allow us to study these types of interactions. And it's, you know, on Earth, it's unethical to take someone and expose them to a radiation beam and see what happens to them. And then they have all these studies with mice, but almost all of them are flawed, because what they do with mice is they take the mouse, and instead of exposing it to a low dose of, or a low rate of radiation over the course of a year, because particle accelerators are expensive, they expose the mouse to a year's worth of radiation in a few seconds or a few minutes. And what we've learned is that the human body has a natural immune system response to DNA damage and to these types of things. And that actually, if you've ever heard of free radicals and antioxidants, that when radiation hits you, it causes the same type of chemical interactions as your body does when its metabolism puts into your body certain types of hydrolyzing chemicals that, you know, the food, you know, if you talk to someone at a health store, they'll be like, eat more antioxidants. And believe it or not, you know, radiation causes very similar types of interactions. And what my personal belief is that, you know, we've been paralyzed on Earth because radiation is so detectable, and the fact that people are so afraid of the word, and, you know, if you get dosed by anything on Earth, that, oh no, I might, you know, develop cancer at some point in my life. But when you go to space, this is going to be a great research ground that I'd like to tell the people out there that are dealing with all of the kind of radiation and health effects that space can offer a way to move forward with learning more about what is the actual human body response to low doses of radiation. And, you know, hopefully space can be a solution for terrestrial technology. And I use this example as the main example, but there's, you know, space offers an environment that challenges innovation. And I think at the end of the day, these new reactor designs and new technologies, some people might say, oh, you know, why do we want to go to space when we have so many problems on Earth? And what I would say is, hey, look, you know, I think that by developing the technology for space, it's going to help us solve the problems for the Earth.
You know, that's a great point. That's something that I always thought was fascinating about how our innate curiosity of exploration gives us so much in the way of technology and understanding of the natural world and order around us. That space, although we have a better understanding of it now, still has so much left to give us in terms of finding out more about ourselves and just making society a better place. So, Dr. Morrison, I appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll have you back on at some point to talk about your company, UltraSafe Nuclear, very soon. So cool. I'm sure we'll be hearing from Chris again on future episodes and probably some of his friends from UltraSafe, but what a cool interview. You know, it just really goes to show you that there is, again, still so much that nuclear has to offer, and that I know younger people, I mean, I could say from experience just in the industry that I've seen a lot of people towards the end of their career are not as optimistic as I am, and maybe some of my peers are about the nuclear industry. They're kind of jaded to the idea that there's could be another renaissance, that there's future use for it. And really, there is. You just have to find the places where it's applicable. And space is certainly one of those things. If you may be feeling discouraged about what the future of nuclear looks like, don't be. Don't be. You know why? Because you have your entire career to shape what it will be. And there is a lot of work to do. It'd be foolish to say that there isn't, but there's a lot of talent. And going to these ANS meetings and meeting with some of my other peers here is always a fun thing for me, just to see what everybody's doing and all the different ways that they're trying to help. And shout out to all those people trying to carve out their own nuclear future to help everyone else succeed. Anyway, thank you for joining me of this installment of Radio Nuclear. Hope you'll be back next time. Who do I have up for a guest next? Well, I know, but you don't know. You have to watch that Twitter feed or subscribe to my mailing address to find out. Be sure to find the links for both of those by heading over to www.radionuclear.org. Scroll down to the bottom of the page, subscribe to that mailing list, and be on the lookout for future big announcements. No, I'm not teasing you. This is real this time. Anyways, thanks again for joining me. I'm your host, Doug Hartmeyer, and have a great rest of your year.